I'm Thorne Dreyer, and this is RAG Radio. My guest today is going to be a Heartland Radical political scientist and peace activist, Harry Targ. We'll get to Harry in a second. This should be a lot of fun. My engineer is Tracy Schultz. Tracy, how are you today?
Doing well, thank you.
And Roger Baker is here. Roger is actually going to join in the discussion maybe at some point when we let him, or when he just grabs the mic.
Hi there.
I want to tell people, you know, as for those of you who don't know, RAG Radio is produced in the studios of Co-op in Austin, 91.7, which is a cooperatively run all-volunteer community radio station. And it's a very, very cool place and has some pretty amazing programming. We are also rebroadcast by WFTE in Mount Cobb in Scranton, Pennsylvania, by KPFT on their HD3 channel in Houston. We are about to be joined by a station in California in the next couple of weeks. And we also are, as of yesterday, a featured podcast on Veterans Today, which is a major website with lots of activity, and we're really happy to be joining Veterans Today. So that's very cool. Lots of stuff going on. Harry Targ. Harry, how are you?
Hi.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, I hear him well. So is your headphones working all right?
Say hello again.
Hello okay, from Indiana.
All right. Harry is a professor of political science and director of peace studies at Purdue University and also a member of the National Executive Committee of the Committees of Correspondence for Democracy and Socialism, CCDS, and is a regular contributor to the RAG blog. And we're going to discuss a whole bunch of stuff on the show. By the way, I mentioned Heartland Radical. Harry is the author of Diary of a Heartland Radical. Harry has taught foreign policy, U.S. Latin American relations, international political economy, labor studies, and peace studies. Harry is a resident of West Lafayette, Indiana. Okay, welcome to RAG Radio, Harry.
Thank you very much.
It's the first time, actually, we've been in contact for a long time, but never by voice.
Yes, and so. I appreciate all that you do, the radio and the blog site is just awesome, and I appreciate being part of it.
Well, thank you. We certainly appreciate it because you bring people should really go to the ragblog.com and search Harry Targ and read some of his work, because what I like so much about the way you write, Harry, is that you take current events, and put them in such wonderful historical context that makes it all, I mean, it's scholarly stuff, but it's very readable, and it I think really informs us. So thank you so much. Thank you so much for being Harry Targ.
Yeah.
So, okay, Harry, the first question I want to ask, what the hell is going on? That may be too broad a question. But,
oh, my goodness.
Isn't it a crazy time we're living in?
I think so. In some ways, you know, when Barack Obama was elected, I used to quote, and everybody else did, the first line of Charles Dickens' Tale of Two Cities, right? The best of times and the worst of times. And it became such a common quote that I stopped using it. But, you know, I think that it might still be relevant for today. The worst of times, growing economic crisis on a worldwide and national basis, increased gaps between rich and poor inside countries and between many countries, particularly the global north and the global south, the drive towards austerity that people, working people and indigenous people, men and women face all across the face of the globe, similar pain and suffering in the United States as well. But the best of times because people are rising up angry, not in a sufficiently organized way, but they're engaging in increasing mobilization, expressions of anger. And perhaps Black Lives Matter is just the most recent of many of these manifestations. And I'm trying to think, you know, how to historicize this current round of uprising. But I suppose we could begin with Arab Spring, although people can pick different dates and movements. and see a period of rising resistance all across the face of the globe. And there's no guarantee that will lead to positive outcomes, but it's possible that it might. So, you know, that's part of the craziness.
Yeah, I have to think that the Occupy movement had an effect beyond what we thought at the time, too.
Mm-hmm.
Well, for one thing, it was an inspiration for Arab Spring and a lot of the stuff that went on in other places. But it seems to me the whole issue of income inequality, which Bernie Sanders is now a phenom, has really caught on in this country. So that's
go ahead. I totally agree. And in some of the things that I've been looking at and writing about, I found data to indicate that incidences of protest all across the globe are increasing dramatically over the last 8 or 10 years. I found one study that documented 847 incidences of protest in 87 countries, and the researchers identified economic issues and the struggle against austerity as the number one motivation, followed by the demand for democratization. And while these protests, some are long, some are short, some are effective, some are ineffective, and they vary based upon local circumstances, the totality of them, it seems to me, involves their similarity, and economics has a whole lot to do with the rising resistance.
You wrote an article, A New Spirit of Revolution, and you talk about co-revolutionary theory, which I think David Harvey, you quote, has written about. And you quote David Harvey as saying, an anti-capitalist, you say that, first in your words, it's too early to tell whether this round of ferment will lead to victories for the people, even reformist ones. But as Harvey suggests, quote, an anti-capitalist political movement can start anywhere. The trick is to keep the political movement moving from one moment to another in mutually reinforcing ways. Are we at a point where what we have to do is figure out how to sort of mutually reinforce these things that are going on? And how to connect them up?
What I like about Harvey's formulation is he's arguing that there's a need to engage in resistance wherever we are located within our societies. And these forms of resistance might involve challenges to sort of ideological hegemony, what he calls mental conceptions, challenges to the use and abuse of nature, drives to build real community, so to support co-op movements where they exist and are growing, traditional workplace struggles against bosses, opposition to racism. And Harvey is arguing that resistance at all these levels in all these places in society are incredibly important. What would be useful is to see a greater connectedness ideologically, theoretically, and practically of these various forms of struggle. And if I could just mention one possible example, we in Indiana were very much interested in just observing from the outside the Moral Mondays movement, which began in North Carolina, inspired by Reverend William Barber. And what intrigued me about Barber, and there's just loads of his stuff on YouTube, and you could follow his historical and theoretical analysis, is his description of three reconstructions, the first one after the Civil War, the second one from Brown versus Board of Education to the Nixon Southern Strategy, and the third, what we're engaged in now. And what he argues is that during these three periods of Reconstruction, and particularly the first, activists engaged in what he calls fusion politics. And I gather that concept comes from the early post-Civil War period. And fusion politics takes as its core message that the only way masses of people, the 99%, if you use the Occupy metaphor, is for people to get together to share their energies and passions on issues that may not be their number one priority. So in other words, what we need to do is to build a movement that fuses the diversity of interests and concerns into one movement. And that's the kind of message that Barber's preaching in North Carolina, and Moral Mondays has spread to several states in the South. There are some pockets of Moral Mondays activity in Pennsylvania, recently in Chicago, and we started a movement in Indiana, and we're trying to build a coalition of partner organizations from NAACP to the labor movement to the Sierra Club SEIU, you know, rise to $15 an hour, and all these different campaigns, and to argue that resistance to them comes from the same place and that we all have to work together. So, you know, I think, you know, starting with your question and my too long response, the Harvey notion of co-revolutionary theory, I think, implies moving to the next step, coming together, developing a fusion of our diverse activities into one big, well-organized and powerful movement. And we're not there yet, but it's possible we might make it.
Well, first, just to mention, I believe that Reverend Barber's, the emphasis now of their organization is on spreading it to the country, mm-hmm. rather than just, you know.
Yeah.
And one of the things that we see is that we've had some pretty remarkable activism in this country. The stuff that happened in Wisconsin, the stuff, the environmental movement around the pipeline, now the Black Lives Matter movement, and the sort of the fight for against institutional or racism, and what I mean, there's a lot of stuff. The Occupy movement was one. Roger,
looks to me like control from the top is kind of breaking down. And when that happens, it sort of creates a political vacuum down below. So I think that people are sort of self-organizing. And, you know, you see some of it coming out through the support for Sanders. And you have a lot of angry voters. So some of it shows up for support like for Trump, who seems equally angry in a sense.
Do you want to respond to that, Harry?
I can't add. I really agree.
Okay.
I think you're right. I think there's growing economic crisis. There's growing legitimacy crisis in the state and state institutions. And that provides, as Roger is saying, an opening for greater mass mobilization.
Okay, when I was bringing up all those specific movements that I think have shown incredible energy and sophistication, in fact, what we don't seem to have, and I know back in the '60s when some of us got started in extra electoral politics, as it were, SDS and whatever, you know, we did. There was an overview theory, you know, we did believe that issues were all interrelated. Right now, it seems that that's got to be the next step with what's going on in this country, don't you think?
I think so, and I think it's happening. You know, I'm a enthusiastic Sanders supporter, and was disappointed that some of his speeches were interrupted. I could understand the motivation behind the interruption. And I think the people engaging in the interruptions were not standing up against the Sanders campaign and what he stood for, but they were demanding that their issues be included as well. And it seems to be the case that Sanders' response was to say, you're right, I'm going to rewrite my agenda to include the central role of racism in American society. So the drive may be towards this fusion. You know, I think that's the kind of impulse. And if you go back to Arab Spring, you know, the metaphor of the students or young people in Tahrir Square ordering pizzas from Madison, Wisconsin for the people out on the street in that city suggests metaphorically the growing sense that we're all in this together. And our struggles are really common struggles. So I think the logic of the situation, the logic of the system, is forcing activists to think about fusion rather than difference.
One thing that, of course, that one helps create instant action, but also that it creates, maybe is helping to create interconnectivity is the internet and social media.
Right.
And that they're playing, a major role in, especially in creating communication avenues for people around the world who are involved in struggles.
And, you know, I feel, because of you at Ragblog, I feel empowered that I could have a public voice, and there's millions of others like me. The problem is when people don't have the ability to evaluate and screen out craziness from good stuff.
Well, that's absolutely the downside to the internet and to social media, isn't it?
There are lots of sites that are well edited now, so you get a pretty good sense of what's from the smart sites, what's really going on.
Yeah, but it's just so easy to spread misinformation very, very quickly, and then once it's out there, you can't take it back.
Is it true? I was a follower and supporter of the Zapatistas, but I gather the awareness of them in North America and the U.S. came from a website at University of Texas. Is that correct? Harry Cleaver?
I think so. I think that certainly played a major role.
Made their movement available to us.
Right.
They may not have been aware of it.
Right, right. No, it's really true. Okay, we need to take a break. I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is Rag Radio. My guest is Harry Targ, political scientist and peace activist. Tracy, take it away.
Tonight, I had a lovely dream. I saw a big parade with ticker tape galore, and men were marching there the likes I've never seen before. The bankers and the diplomats are going in the army. Oh, happy day, I'd give my pay to see them on their way. Their paunches at attention and their striped pants at ease. They're getting patriotic and they're going overseas. We'll have to do the best we can and bravely carry on. So we'll just keep the laddies here to manage while they're gone. Gentlemen of distinction in the army.
Ah, we can all have our fantasies. Okay, we're talking with Harry Targ, who is a professor of political science and director of peace studies at Purdue University. Welcome back, Harry.
Thank you.
We'll talk about Iran and the treaty. We'll talk about Cuba. And what's happening in the rest of Greece, whatever. I want to get into all of those things, and I know those are things that you think a lot about and have strong opinions about. And both Cuba and Iran, incidentally, have also, when we're talking about the crazy political schisms right now in this country, that those are well at play. We were talking about sort of what's happening now with the spirit of revolution, talking about Black Lives Matter movement and the Bernie Sanders campaign. And I, incidentally, am one who believes that what happened with Black Lives Matter demonstrators was probably the best thing that could possibly have happened to the Bernie Sanders campaign.
Oh, okay.
Because the Sanders campaign has a serious problem with being basically all white. And, Sanders comes out of a state with almost no minority population. And and if you look at the crowds, generally, the crowds, there's very few minorities in the crowds. And I think it's a time.
I would say, fortunately, in his case, he has a very good civil rights record.
Yeah, but that doesn't matter at this point in time. Well, it matters. But I think that the fact that as a result of that, he responded and addressed the issue. He hired a communications expert who came out of that movement. I think if Sanders is to, in the long run, to be relevant, then I think that's a move that had to happen. So anyway, my little piece of whatever.
One day on MSNBC, Michael Eric Dyson pointed out that the reaction to that protest and disruption of DeSantis' speech, and was that the very next day he went ahead and drafted an agenda that would prioritize issues of the need for police reform and so on, so that his reaction was just the kind of reaction that is needed.
Right. Right. And I think that the campaign responded very well. What do you think, briefly, about what's going on? What do you have an opinion about the Trump phenomenon?
I follow, as I know you do as well, comments by liberal and left activists on the internet. There are some people that are arguing that Trump is reflecting a kind of 21st century fascism, and I'm uncomfortable with that analysis. I think fascism involves a kind of systematic theoretical orientation, an organization, an appeal to a certain class of people, and I just, maybe I'm naive, but I don't find Trump to be that effective. And I tend to be one of those who argue that Trump is, to a good part, a media creation. I'm addicted to MSNBC, despite all their flaws.
And despite their changes.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And they've been spending every show that I've watched until I fall asleep on the couch. The 20 minutes each hour has been on Trump over the last month and a half. I gathered the same thing in CNN. So they've made a candidate out of him.
Well, but he also had all the skills. I mean, he's the only guy in the field who actually is a television star.
You're right.
And it's not just that they made him that, he knew how to play that. To the larger question, I tend to agree that I don't see it being indicative of a fascist movement, but I do think that what he's touching is reinforcing is a stream of sort of nativism and racism that's kind of frightening, right wing populism,
right.
The thing that makes him, I only recently started thinking maybe I should take him seriously, because what he's doing on issues like Social Security, like Medicare, like health care, and a number of other things, he's actually taken moderate positions. Mm. And the base of the Republican Party, for the most part, has moderate positions on those issues.
Well, one thing he does that makes him stand out is saying that Congress is for sale. Other politicians on that side are saying that?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So he's a mixed, he's really a mixed bag in the political arena. And those other, 16 or 17 Republican candidates are all utterly and completely reactionary.
Right. Reactionary to him, in addition to being reactionary.
That's right.
Right. The Sanders campaign brings up another question, which is the whole question of, somebody who calls himself a socialist, a democratic socialist, who's called himself a democratic socialist since, for decades and decades since he entered the political arena, and that doesn't seem to work against him. Maybe it would in a general election, but it, one of the things that's very interesting is how socialism maybe polls a little differently now, especially among younger people who didn't grow up in the Cold War and McCarthyism and stuff. You call yourself a socialist, don't you?
Yes. I tend not to label myself very much in the classroom, but I don't shy away from it if it comes up, right?
Well, I know we've talked with Carl Davidson about this question on this show more than once, and he kind of thinks own up to it. I don't know, it's just interesting. It's certainly interesting the way that seems to suddenly be an acceptable.
Right, there's a lot of polling data to indicate that significant percentage of population would not be opposed to socialism, 35-40%, and particularly in a higher percentage among that youngest cohort. And like you say, they're not children of the Cold War, so they don't have all that baggage to inhibit their support of socialism or suspiciousness of it.
All right, this is an amazing moment in Cuban and American relations, U.S.-Cuban relations. You've written a lot about the history of the relations between Cuba and the U.S. and its the historical context. What is your take right now on what's going on, and what does it mean historically?
Well, it's obviously it's significant historically. I think the opening of relations is, on the whole, will be beneficial to Cuba. The final end to the economic blockade, which hasn't occurred yet, will be beneficial to Cuba and the Cuban economy. As you know, the Cubans themselves have been rethinking their forms of economic organization. There are the 300 regulations that were began to be discussed in 2011 and have been adopted by the Cuban government. And main features of those regulations include downsizing the state sector, and the downsizing involves a shift to private enterprise and or workplace cooperatives. And the people who I listen to and find convincing are major advocates of building workplace cooperatives as one manifestation of 21st century socialism. And these cooperatives are being created in the city, in Havana and other cities, as well as in the agricultural sector. And the private enterprise tends to be a small-scale restaurants and street vendors and taxi cab drivers and so on, sectors of the economy that some people have argued need not have been part of the state sector at all. And so this is a critical moment for Cuba as well. Will it sort of embrace a new kind of grassroots socialism, but maintaining the spirit of the revolution? Or will it tilt in the direction of sort of so-called free market capitalism? And I think that Cuba will continue to move in the direction of 21st century socialism and maintain the kind of essence of what the Cuban Revolution has always meant. But it's too a little problematic. And as you know, people sort of speculate about what happens when U.S. capital gets an even bigger foothold on the island. And I think the Cuban people and the Cuban government have institutionalized a sort of communitarian socialist spirit and will resist a kind of neoliberalism that's being promoted all across the globe.
Tell us what you mean by 21st century socialism.
Well, it's a... you know, I suppose we could have lots of definitions, but a socialism that maintains the essence of the spirit of community consciousness, altruism, spirit of, you know, collective well-being in the context of a global political economy that's still dominated by capitalism. And I think when people talk about 21st century socialism, say in Latin America, they're talking about what's going on in Venezuela, they're talking about the workplace cooperatives in Cuba. Carl Davidson, as you know, has been a major advocate for co-ops in the United States. Lots of people look to the large-scale cooperative workplace organization in Spain, Mondragon. And so there are a lot of people.
Yeah, we did a whole show with him about Mondragon.
Oh, okay. So,
yeah,
and so there, you know, there are a lot of people that believe that, you know, when people talk about, okay, you tell me you're a socialist, what does that mean? And there are a lot of folks like Carl and David Schweikert and others who say, well, among the things that 21st century socialism mean is greater workplace participation in the control and the direction of economic activity. Increase the role of the 99% in the workplace running the financial system at local, state, and national levels. And so I think that's what 21st century socialism is.
And maybe a little more emphasis on human rights?
I would say so, right. And a greater emphasis upon grassroots democratization.
Right. Participatory democracy.
I think so. You were talking about from our era when it was a couple years ago when people were celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Port Huron Statement. I went back and looked at that document, and I decided it was still a pretty good statement.
Yeah, we did a show with Tom. I'm sorry, I'm talking about our archives here, but we did a show with Tom Hayden talking about that right at that time. And it really is amazing how much of a living document it is, I think.
Right. You know. And you talk about my historical proclivities, or maybe it's because of my age. I think back on some of my early heroes before I got politically involved at all, people like Paul Goodman. When I first came to Purdue, I had the opportunity of teaching small undergraduate classes about the New Left and what was going on in the late 60s. And we talked a lot about community, and we read some of the utopians and the anarchists, and we read Paul Goodman. And
there was also, I think, a Texas boy named C. Wright Mills, too.
Oh, yeah. I've heard of him.
Yeah. All right, Roger had...
Oh, I wanted to make a comment about 21st century socialism, and that would be that I think we're now facing a world of resource limits, like, you know, burning carbon and, you know, just the cost of energy. In my opinion, a high cost of energy finally broke the economy, and now we're facing an economy without growth, and that's sort of contrary to, you know, capitalist business as usual. So we're facing a different kind of future due to a lot of resource limits that we aren't accustomed to taking into account.
Right. I'm glad you raised that, and I should have, and it's one of my weaknesses to not give sufficient attention to the environment and the need for, you know, thinking about no growth or selective growth in the economy and green jobs agenda and all of those elements. That's just so important nowadays. And I'm impressed with the scientific reports I see friends refer to that predict utter and complete physical collapse of the natural environment in the next 20 years unless we do some very radical things to change the direction of where we're going.
Well, that brings into, you know, to mind the question of whether we could have a no-growth socialism. I don't know if that's possible, but that may be where we're headed.
All right, well, I think we're about ready to take another break here. Are we, Tracy? I'm Thorne Dreyer, this is Rag Radio, and my guest is Harry Targ, and that other voice that you hear on occasion is our own Roger Baker. We'll be right back.
Guantanamera, Guajira, Guantanamera, Guantanamera, Guajira, Guantanamera. Yo soy un hombre sincero, de donde crece la palma. Yo soy un hombre sincero, de donde crece la palma. Antes de morir me quiero, echa mis versos del alma. Guantanamera, Guajira, Guantanamera, Guantanamera, Guajira, Guantanamera. Mi verso es de una verde clara.
En esta tierra de sol, que dice Cuba se llama, en esta
esta tierra de sol, que dicen Cuba sería más linda pie de tambor. Ay, 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 donde llama tú verás.
Guantanamera, Guajira, Guantanamera, Guantanamera, Guajira, Guantanamera.
Tracy Schultz, we had two different versions of Guantanamera there.
Yeah, yeah. Go ahead.
Timely to our discussion, I should mention.
Yeah, and the good choices. That was Los Lobos doing a live version, and then right before it, Pete Seeger doing a classic version. And I got to say, Pete Seeger's Spanish is on point. That's some great pronunciation.
Are you an expert in the area?
I'm just very terrible at Spanish, so I can appreciate somebody who does it right.
You can see it, you can not do it. Okay. Harry Targ is professor of political science and director of peace studies at Purdue University. He's a regular contributor to the RAC blog and is one of the people I most like to read about issues, a number of different issues, and especially about about the peace movement and where it's going, which is the direction I'd like to to go right now. It's kind of a difficult segue there, but first, let me ask you about the treaty with Iran and what you think about that and what you think about what's going to happen with it.
Okay, I think, well, we didn't plan very much. I think there's a sort of interconnectedness in our various discussions. I've written things that you've published on the sort of two major and conflicting forces inside the United States foreign policy establishment. Both factions, I think, are interested in promoting and maintaining U.S. hegemony on a worldwide basis. But they disagree as to strategy and tactics. One group I call the globalists, or we might call the neocons, and they're most directly reflected in the Project for a New American Century and most of George Walker Bush's key aides. And the other, as I call the pragmatists, including sometimes President Obama, who argue that we ought to use a variety of tools to achieve our ends, including diplomacy. The globalists and neocons, I think, are most characterized by promoting militarism, and the pragmatists, while sharing the same overall vision of the U.S. role in the world, see the necessity of using diplomacy, engaging with other countries, particularly allies, getting their support, engaging in international organizations. And so I see one could sort of, in an oversimplified way, look at United States foreign policy from the end of World War II as a kind of struggle between the kind of militarist faction and the more pragmatic faction. And I think what appealed to so many of us about Obama in 2008 and his enormous popularity on a worldwide basis was his call for the use of diplomacy as the traditional tool that it always has been in international relations, and to reject militarism, the use of military force, as the primary tool to achieve U.S. goals. And I would say Obama's track record since 2008 has been very mixed. On the negative side, we have this dramatic increase in the use of drones. He sent more troops into Afghanistan. He's flirted directly with war in Syria and backed off. Some of his people, I think, played a leading role in undermining the Ukraine government and is trying to use Ukraine to push NATO and Western Europe eastward at the expense of Russia. Obama was ultimately supportive of the coup in Honduras and has added bases to Colombia. I'm emphasizing more of the negative than I truly feel. But on the other hand, he's been an advocate for diplomacy. He's been an advocate for changing the U.S.-Cuban relation. And in this deal with this negotiated agreement with Iran, he's taking the view that we should work with our allies, the other countries on the Security Council, and work with Iran to achieve an agreement that is more or less mutually satisfactory. Any possible threat of Iran's development of nuclear weapons would be dramatically reduced, in exchange for which the economic sanctions against Iran would be eliminated. And I'm looking in my notes, and I don't know if I could. Well, here's the statement. President Obama made a speech on August 5th endorsing and encouraging support for the Iranian agreement. And he made a very fine statement. He said, we have to end the mindset that got us there in the first place, that is the war in Iraq and instability in the Middle East. It was a mindset characterized by a preference for military action over diplomacy, a mindset that put a premium on unilateral U.S. action over the painstaking work of building international consensus, a mindset that exaggerated threats beyond what the intelligence supported. So from my point of view, this was a very good statement, and the peace movement, in my judgment, should be supporting the Iran deal and supporting this more theoretical statement that Obama made about the necessity of engaging in diplomacy and challenging this mindset that military options should be the first priority of U.S. foreign policy. And so we're in the midst of extraordinary political struggle over the Iran treaty, because these two different factions are at loggerheads. The globalists, the neocons, the sort of next generation of PNAC folks, versus people who believe that we ought to use diplomacy and avoid getting involved in costly and brutal wars. And at this point in time, we've talked about movements, the first part of this program. My sense is that the peace movement is weaker and is less organized and mobilized than the other sectors of this emerging fusion politics movement that we've been talking about.
I was going to ask you the question, is there a peace movement? That was so.
Right. I think it's weaker. And part of, you know, my problem as someone involved in Indiana Moral Mondays is that Reverend Barber in North Carolina, they defined their movement as largely domestic and even state-directed, because state governments have adopted these horrific laws that limit the right to vote, that reduce access to health care, that are trying to privatize education. So appropriately, these movements need to attack or respond to reaction within the states. But I think the peace movement needs to be involved and try and convince these kind of domestically oriented movements that there's an international dimension and that military expenditures is part of this whole ball of wax about U.S. empire and neoliberal globalization. And the peace movement, I think, has been unfortunately weakened dramatically over the last 3 or 4 years.
Yeah, there was an upsurge around Iraq, but
mm-hmm. And many of us went in the streets when Obama was talking about bombing Syria, and yeah. I like to think that we had a role to play in pressuring him not to do that.
Have ISIS and Al Qaeda and that struggle sort of diffused the peace movement a little bit? Do you think?
I think you're right. And it complicates the picture enormously, right? And it's difficult to know what's going on, who the actors are, which side or sides the United States is supporting, the Saudis are supporting, and so on. And I think maybe the complication of it is it puts us in a much more difficult position than, say, the Vietnam era when we were growing up.
question, when you were talking about the two forces, and then Roger has something else, and I'll get back to him in a second. When you were talking about the two forces at play in American foreign policy, do you think that Hillary Clinton would take us maybe a half step back in the direction of the neocons?
I think so. One significant but not only reason why I personally am very enthusiastic about Bernie Sanders and am not at all enthusiastic about Hillary Clinton is because she, I think, would support more interventionism. In some of my writings, as you know, I talk about the so-called liberal interventionists. And this sort of faction is not quite pragmatic, but takes the view that selectively we ought to use military means to achieve our ends, and we ought to use military means to support, quote, human rights. And so the language, the rationale for military intervention is a little different than the neocons, but the outcome is similar. I think Secretary of State Clinton was an active supporter of overthrowing the Gaddafi government in Libya, and what has been left in its wake is incredible instability and violence. I think she represents that. She and the people she's close with were supporters of the coup in Honduras. So under the aegis of liberal your humanitarian interventionism, a different rationale is presented for the same kind of use of military that should be opposed. And I'm very suspicious of Hillary Clinton's track record in this regard.
Roger Baker. By the way, we're talking with Harry Targ and occasionally Roger Baker.
I saw some good news today. There was an article in Bloomberg News, and that said that that AIPAC, which is one of the biggest opponents of the Iranian peace deal, may be overextended on this issue.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there is kind of a consensus among the sane leaders in the world that we probably ought to be making a deal like this. So I would say that that's good news.
Yes, it is. And, you know, the data indicates, you know, you might call a Jewish American, and the majority of Jewish Americans support the deal, whereas, you know, AIPAC plays a significant role in pressuring policymakers. Their agenda is not necessarily the agenda of Jewish Americans, in the same way that the opponents of Obama's warming of relations with Cuba are not opposed by most Cuban Americans. So it's just these interest groups have inordinate power beyond the popularity of their positions among their own constituents.
Okay, the left are whatever we exist now that we would maybe put under that umbrella. One of the things you've talked about is inside-outside strategy, whether people, because there are those on the left who think it's virtually a sin to work within electoral politics at all. But you think that that's an important arena, right?
Yes, there still seems to be this lingering debate, and I don't know how significant it is. It may be just a reflection of who my Facebook friends are, but there seems to be a number of folks who traditionally either reject ever supporting a Democrat or advocate only supporting third parties, or rejecting electoral politics altogether. And my own view is that that's short-sighted, that we have to look at context. And there are differences, as Carl Davidson and others have written about, between some Democrats, so-called Blue Dog Democrats, and members of the Progressive Caucus and the Black Caucus in the House and in the Senate. And that in the world in which we live, where our choices are limited. If we see candidates who support the kind of positions that we do, I think we need to support them. And one of the biggest disasters in terms of recent politics was our lack of mobilization in the 2010 off-year elections, which led to 30 states going red. And that 2010 election has done more to cause pain and suffering to Americans, black and white, men and women, straight and gay, as any election that I remember of growing up. So, you know, I think elections matter. When we talk to most of our friends, whether they're politically engaged or not, you mention the word politics, they're thinking elections, and the left would make a big mistake to ignore that, ignore the electoral arena, because that's how people relate to the political process at all.
And do we choose marginalization, or do we choose some kind of relevance, I guess, is what you said, is the question. Quickly, we're down to about 4 minutes. Greece, has the anti-austerity, and new elections have been called, has the anti-austerity movement basically run its course? I mean, I know that popular sentiment in Greece is still very much to the left. What do you think is happening there? What's going to happen quickly? That could be a half an hour discussion.
Right. Well, I can answer quickly. I just don't know enough of what's going on in the ground. But I think this feeling of opposition to austerity still is well grounded in Greece, is spread to Spain, and will continue to spread as long as the European banks insist upon draconian measures to squeeze working people in those countries. The specific Greek case itself, I'm not familiar enough with local politics and whether Syriza will lose some of its popularity as a result of its kind of caving or making agreement with the European banks.
Okay. All right. What would you like to finish with? What haven't we talked about that you would like to cover
in
a couple of minutes?
Well, this might be silly, but I think it might be relevant from where you're at. Eugene V. Debs, the five-time candidate for president of the U.S., was born in Indiana, Terre Haute, Indiana, and there's a Debs house, and every year there's a dinner in which an award is given to someone who's engaged in politics in the spirit of Debs. And we went once and saw Your Own Citizen Jim Hightower. And he said at the end of his talk, he said, "I want to leave you with one thought. Even the smallest of dogs can pee on the side of a big building." And I think that's terribly inspirational. And maybe it's common to Texas political philosophy. I don't know.
Well, one strain of Texas political philosophy. Of course, there's a great, I should mention, incidentally, that Jim Hightower will be our guest on RAG Radio in 2 weeks, and is one of our is a frequent guest and is somebody that we love, and that it's always a great show when we have Jim Hightower. That whole kind of populist sentiment, of course, the populist movement started in Texas. So there's, Texas gets a bad rap sometimes, the people that the Texas state government causes that to happen to a great extent.
Right. Incidentally, one year the Debs Society gave an award to Molly Ivins as well, and there was a large crowd to hear her, about 700 people, I think.
Molly Ivins was a trip, and we miss her dearly.
Yeah.
So, okay. Well, thank you so much for being with us, Harry Targ, and we'll do this again sometime.
Great. Thank you for inviting me.
Oh,
thanks, Roger.
It's been a pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Roger says thanks, too.
Okay, great.
All right, Tracy, we have, of course, the co-op membership drive is coming up starting next week.
Yeah.
And we have... Jim Hightower is going to be on the show during that time, and also the world music band Atash is going to be on our show. And I would also, well, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, it's like, since we're talking about the membership drive, if you care to donate early to Co-op Radio before a membership drive, it's like through koop.org. Anybody who makes any donation at this time before we actually kick it off between now and next week gets their name in the running to win an Apple Watch, which was donated graciously to our station from the folks at Apple. So,
too cool.
Something to think about.
I should mention that we're trying to work out a date for a show with James Galbraith, the economist. And also, coming up in September, Ed Sanders.
Nice.
Member of the historic, legendary band, The Fugs, a Renaissance man, a poet, a writer, a maker of rare musical instruments, and all of that. I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is Rag Radio.